Glee Glee Studios and the New Mercury Players present Antonio's Answer, a radical steampunk short story from the Catastrophone Orchestra collection. Antonio's Answer originally appeared in Steampunk Magazine, used in an almost forgotten Victoria-era writing genre known as the seasonal format. These seasonals loosely follow the exploits of a 19th century band of miscreants who are working on the most dangerous and revolutionary piece of musical equipment ever to have existed, the Catastrophone. The radical short story you're about to hear is one of many seasonals gathered into an anthology known as the Catastrophone Orchestra, which is available from the dangerous fiction publishing collective Combustion Books. The New Mercury Players is proud to introduce to our stage for the very first time professional voice actor Ben Church. Sit back and relax as Ben takes you to the dusty streets of 19th century New York City. I'm sure you'll enjoy the ride.
Every creature in sky and on earth and under the earth and in the sea, every beast in the universe, cry out to the one who sits on the throne, who will answer our cries. Revelations 5:13. Antonio's Answer by the Catastrophone Orchestra. New York City, October 3rd, 1890-something. The howls of the Catastrophone exploded through the cluttered free clinic, sending musical shards flying out the door onto Delancey Street. Columns of roiling steam poured from two of the instrument's many cannon-like pipes, engulfing Professor Calamity and hampering his search for a makeshift cricket cage. Neil List, knowing that his voice would not be heard over the roaring and clanking of the instrument, threw his recently pilfered copy of the Herald down and marched through the artificial fog towards Pip, the instrument's caretaker. Through his welding goggles, Pip saw only the white of Neil's mohawk, not the heavy, meaty hand that cuffed him so hard his teeth clattered. Pip turned one of the brass valves, smarting from the ex-steelworker's blow. The instrument shimmied, sputtered, and finally became silent. Neil flopped back down onto his orange crate and picked up the funnies again, while Calamity continued to search, stepping over a murky puddle of discharge.
"It's madness, this cricket idea of yours," Pip said, turning a few more knobs and locking a lever in place.
"Madness?" the professor asked, turning to gaze down at Pip. "What would you know about madness? Do not forget, my young Pip, with whom you are conversing. I have not only studied madness, I fell in love with it."
The professor gave a slight bow in the direction of Matilda, who was applying arsenic to her face on the other side of the room. Calamity had worked for years in the screeching bedlam of Bellevue as an alienist before moving to the Lower East Side, squatting the Free Clinic, and forming the Catastrophone Orchestra. His lover and main operator, Screaming Matilda, was certifiably insane. Pip knew all of this, but he also knew that the professor's idea was nothing more than sheer lunacy.
"Look, the Catastrophone operates at 95 PSI minimum. Those pedal steel drumatones we just built, they had to be increased just so they could be heard above it. I had to double up the chain states to get enough velocity." Pip trailed off as he tried to re-zero a cracked gauge.
"Yet an angel's sigh can be heard across the world. We need something else, something subtle, a sound to add to our wonderful machines. We need something organic. To fully capture the music, to transform the listeners," Calamity said, now searching his empty opium vials for an appropriate cricket receptacle.
"Listeners would be nice," Neil said from behind his paper. The others paid him no mind.
"It's just not mathematically possible, Calamity," Pip said, retrieving a mop to slop up the mess from the machine.
"Mathematics, that is exactly the point. Barbs divide the length of the golden cricket's back leg. With proper breeding, an individual with enough foresight
may breed crickets that play notes. Specific, separate, and discrete notes. There is an exact and well-known formula. High temperatures produce specific legumes. This is why men who work the land can determine the temperature in the fields on the basis of the cricket's song. Don't you see, my boy? We can heat up our specially bred crickets to play anything we like. Think of it as the first organic organ, Calamity exclaimed, knocking a tin of twice-used coffee grounds onto the threadbare rug. Matilda checked her midnight blue lipstick and rose from her razor-bearer. She ducked under one of the Catastrophone's vents, crossed over to Calamity, and gently touched his bony shoulder.
These plebeians have no understanding of art, but you believe in me, my dear Matilda, he said, pulling her into his track-marked arms.
She purred and reached past him, lifting down a black beribboned hat box and handing it to him.
I don't want to keep the society waiting.
Brilliant!
Calamity said as he took the box. I'll go and fetch some rolled oats for our little insects. I'll meet you on the corner.
The doctor dipped into Neil's vest pocket and removed a few tattered dollars.
Matilda, you know he'll never make it to Canal Street. There are at least 3 poppy parlors on the way to the Chinaman's pet shop, Neil said, without looking up from his paper.
How much did he take?
Matilda asked.
Most of our tobacco money, and a bit of the food, too, Neil answered.
Then you just make sure he comes back with at least half. You know that the doctor sometimes forgets that the rest of us need to eat.
Matilda navigated her way past the urchins sharing a cigarette on the stone steps of the Henry Street settlement. Inside, the foyer smelled of unwashed diapers and 5-cent cigars. She stole a glance at a bulletin board advertising English classes, a lecture by the infamous anarchist Johann Most, and free tuberculosis testing. She walked past the kitchen where sincere reformers worked to prepare the evening's turnip stew. The library door was open, and through it she heard the voices of a society debating.
"Greetings, Matilda! We were just speaking of the incident at Coney Island with the butcher and that poor elephant," Father Martin said, as he rose from the table.
If the society had wanted a leader, it would have undoubtedly been Father Martin. His duties, caring for the poor as one of the Franciscan order, had allowed him to move in many circles. It was from these different spheres he first drew together the Society for the Enrichment of Animal Welfare, which was commonly referred to as the Society. When the Society had first begun 3 years previously, many more people had attended the monthly soirees and lectures, but it had, in recent months, dwindled to a monthly gathering of no more than a handful of like-minded folk.
"How much electricity does it take to kill an elephant, anyways?" Matilda asked a rotund man who sat by the window eating a cookie.
Along with Matilda, the pot-bellied Dr. Tarr had been there since the beginning, when the society was still idealistic and fired by dreams of action. Dr. Tarr, ever the martyr, had continued to put out the Society's Gazette long after the subscription rates had dropped. He was always the first to arrive to the meetings, and he always brought lemon seed cookies that his wife had baked the night before. Clearly, Tarr had married a woman who could indulge in his love of both desserts and stray cats. The man was a hard worker, and he was the last remaining full-time animal doctor in Manhattan.
"Matilda, that is dreadful! Who cares how much electricity? It's terrible!" said Mrs. Halsworth, "and it's on all the papers, and why, no one's lifting a finger. I heard the mayor was even there."
Mrs. Halsworth was the wife of an investment lawyer. She used as much of his money as she dared to care for ex-racing horses on their property in Tarrytown.
"Do you think they ate it after they cooked it?" Matilda asked, folding her hands in her lap. "I must say, the things that pop into your mind," Halsworth shook her head. "You know meat-eating is criminal. It ought to be a crime."
"Or at least a sin," Matilda replied, looking at the priest.
The conversation died as Antonio, the society's newest member, entered. All eyes were on the balding Italian, who quickly took his seat opposite the Franciscan. Silence filled the book-lined room.
"Antonio, I was very sorry to hear," Halsworth broke the silence.
The rest nodded in agreement. As if on cue, Antonio started uncontrollably hacking into a stained handkerchief.
"Thanks. It's all right. So, what were you all talking about?"
Father Martin recapped the discussion and the news articles on the electrocution of Topsy, the elephant in Luna Park.
So it would seem, Mrs. Holdsworth, that technology is not going to be the savior of animals as you have so often suggested,
Dr. Tarr said.
Nonsense. Edison is a lunatic, an aberration. In the future, there will be no need for animals to be eaten or worked to death, Holdsworth replied.
There will always be a need for animals to aid man in his labor,
Tarr said.
How can you say that? Why, it goes against progress. You already see the mule teams on the Erie being replaced by steam engines, and last summer in London I rode in a steam carriage. It was such fun to whiz about the streets in it. The museums were also very impressive. You should really go sometime. Now, where was I?
Whizzing around London, Matilda smirked.
Yes. No.
Oh, yes. I believe the twilight has already begun for beasts of burden and the animals of the field. Steam tractors will liberate the draft horses and the tired donkey,
Holdsworth said, building a head of rhetorical steam.
I don't believe all of that, but you must admit that there will always be a need for meat,
Dr. Tarr said.
Need? Meat is a murderous abomination. Soon we will all be like the Japanese, eating only healthy vegetables. When I was in Tokyo on my honeymoon, the food was simply amazing. They did eat fish, but most of it was rice and vegetables.
Murder? Father, have you heard such nonsense? The study of nature is the study of violence. The lion eats the gazelle because food is food. We must eat to live. I cannot agree that there is anything wrong with eating meat so long as the animals are treated humanely. Let the chicken have a good life before she's put into the pot, I've always said. And that has been my work for all of these years. No one loves the animals more than me.
Do you often eat your loved ones? Matilda asked.
Holdsworth continued to protest against meat and for the redemptive power of technology, while Dr. Tarr offered up a lackluster defense between bites of cookie. Matilda half listened, tossing in a verbal bomb every now and then. Father Martin had heard it all before. The conversations, the debates. He longed to free animals, and he had once hoped that his little society could be an agent in that struggle to advance mankind. His faith had always given him comfort. He thought fondly of St. Francis, how that holy man had extended his love to all the beasts, how he had reached communion with both God and his creations. Yes, that would be an excellent beginning for his sermon, he thought. Martin had yet to write his sermon for St. Francis's feast, which was the following day, and he had hoped that the society would bring him inspiration. I am sorry, my friends, but I must go and prepare a sermon. You are welcome to continue your conversation. We have the room for another hour, he said. Before he left, he looked over at poor Antonio. He had known the man for perhaps 6 months at most, but he knew that Antonio was a good, solid friend of the animals. He was more than a little sad that the Italian stagehand was dying. He wondered how many more meetings Antonio would be able to attend as he looked over and found him trying to stifle a cough. Antonio, would you like to accompany me back to the rectory for some fresh air? Martin asked. None of the others heard Antonio's response. He simply rose and followed the priest out. The sounds of the society's argument followed them down the hall. Father Martin was feeling good about himself. He had told Antonio all the right things, given him a speech he had honed in his years of visiting hospitals and sick beds. He had done his good work for the day, and had more than a start on his sermon. It was always the most interesting sermon of the year. "Well, Antonio, I trust we will see you at the next meeting." Father Martin shook the hand of the dying man, who would not let go.
Father, there is something weighing on me. I am confused.
I believe that is natural, Antonio, but you must not fret. You are in God's perfect grace.
Thank you. But what I am confused about is how to make a real impact. You started the society. It must have been a disappointment to you. For 2 years, nothing has changed. Even fewer people come now. Even Professor Feather hasn't been around,
Antonio said, wringing his well-worn hat. An impact? What kind of impact? I'm afraid I don't understand. Martin felt something behind the man's words, something dark that made the hairs along his arms rise. He could not quite grasp the source, but something made him terribly uneasy. What are you planning, Antonio? Martin whispered.
I have a bomb.
The priest instinctively took a step backward, almost slipping off the curb.
Not with me, Father! The Italian smiled.
Placing his cap on his head, and standing straighter, he continued,
"The theater may have killed me with its chemicals, but my life will not be wasted. No, sir, I got most of it worked out."
"You can't be serious," Martin said.
grabbing Antonio's sleeve and pulling him closer.
Deadly serious, I assure you. There is nothing you can do to stop me. I have already let my room go, and I am going to get my bomb. The only question I have is where I should go.
Go? Perhaps we'll go inside and talk.
The cruelty is out there, Father,
Antonio said, waving his arm to the city.
There are so many wrongs. Helpless Bisa will never ask for any of this. You have been involved in a struggle longer than I have, longer than any of them. I am not looking for your blessing, Father. Just point me in a direction where my death will have the most meaning, relieve the most suffering. That is what we all want. We all do it in our own ways. The doctor, with his practice helping mend poodles, and Mrs. Holdsworth, with her crippled racehorses. Matilda, well, I'm not sure what she does. You with her words, and me with
a bomb?
Yes.
Martin didn't know what to do. If he went to the police, Antonio would surely be gone before he returned. He might even be forced to do something dangerously foolish. It was true Martin didn't know this man well, but he believed he could change his mind. He just needed more time with him.
It is clear you will not help me.
Antonio began to walk down the street. Antonio, wait, where are you going? Let me come with you, Martin pleaded. If nothing else, Martin thought, Antonio wouldn't blow himself up with a priest at his side.
I kept notes, you know. Don't say much at the meetings, but I hear.
Antonio pulled out crumpled articles from the Society's bulletins. What is that? The priest asked.
Places you all talked about. I'm going to check them out, find where I can do the most for the animals. If you want to come, you can. Maybe you can help me pick the best one.
Or none, Martin silently added to himself.
It's too bad Dr. Tarr isn't with us,
Antonio said, stepping carefully to avoid a half-congealed puddle of blood. Martin's response was drowned out by the steam horn, which blew loudly from the frigate sliding out from the Chelsea piers. From 20th Street all the way to the 40s, snaking along the river was New York's ever-busy meatpacking district. Cows from Chicago were chased down chutes on the piers, bumping into guinea fowl from St. Lucia. Slick urine and feces-covered ramps crisscrossed the waterfront, connecting dark, windowless sheds. The animals were herded into these perverse arcs, most often at night, their last earthly communications echoing across the water to the Palisades. A few blocks further, towards the interior of Manhattan, were the meat houses. Horse-drawn trucks dropped off full carcasses to be alchemically transformed into dinner chops. It was through these gory alleys that Antonio searched for the LaFontaine brothers. "Where are we going?" Martin asked, horrified by two strays pulling at an unidentifiable piece of forgotten entrails in the gloom.
"Here we are,"
Antonio said, as he pulled himself onto a loading dock. A man with the body of an ape and the face of a child met Antonio on the deck. He casually carried a 50-pound block of ice on his toweled shoulders. His bare chest was streaked with blood. The butcher dropped the ice and held out his hand to help heave the priest onto the slippery deck.
"You are very welcome, Father," the man said in a heavy continental accent.
"You are French?" the priest said, trying not to stare at the man's bloody torso.
"Belge, actually," the man replied, following the priest's eyes with his own. "Sorry. Aprons soak up too fast, and they cost 10 cents a cleaning. It is easier to just wash off. So you come for the chavo piggies, yes, man of taste. Better to prepare it yourself than to have it at some mangy restaurant, no?"
Antonio and Martin ducked under the leather flap separating the dock from the interior. Martin was shocked by the number of laborers moving around in the gray-tiled hall. Gleaming knives, powerful cleavers, and flexing saws moved in silence like the choreography of a botch scene. Martin followed the hulking Belgian across the well-lit slaughter floor to a metal staircase. The Belgian stopped and grabbed a sputtering hurricane lantern.
"Watch your heads, yes?" he smiled, descending the wrought-iron stairs.
Martin grabbed Antonio's arm and pulled him close, whispering,
"What are we doing here? I have read the article too, you know. Have you ever seen it? I mean, not at a restaurant with orange sauce, but actually seen it,"
Antonio answered.
"No,"
Martin admitted, watching the glow of the lantern dance further away into the depths of the building.
"Neither have I. Let's go."
The cellar was low, and the men had to crouch to avoid banging their skulls on the exposed beams. The sound was disturbing. Whirling gears and crushing noises filled the low basement as if a giant was grinding the bones of unlucky Englishmen to make his bread. The temperature in the cellar was at least 20 degrees higher than on the ice-covered cutting floor. In the back were rows of small cages filled with bloated piglets, their heads tethered upwards as if they were singing in a ghastly choir, though no sound escaped their throats.
At first Martin thought the animals were dead, that strange copper birds of prey were picking at the succulent bodies. As his eyes adjusted, he began to see the clunking contraptions with flapping bellows, the spinning gears crushing glass, the tangles of copper tubing that extended to an iron shelf of upturned bottles with French labels. The entire mechanism was powered by a small glowing boiler that sat like a burning egg under the mechanical vulture.
"The light is bad for the meat, yes? Many others take shortcuts, keep them exposed. Many shorter cuts, but we are Belges. This is the real chevaux piggies," the Belgian said, like a proud parent showing off his son's trophies to a house guest.
Martin knew what those tubes snaking down the pig's throats were for. They were filled with some type of liquor, usually anise-flavored, but sometimes something more exotic, like chokeberry. Martin could no longer stand the sight. He turned, looking for the stairs, toppling something that clanked and smashed on the stone floor. The huge Belgian bent down and picked up a brown shard of glass.
"Yes, you see, we only use brown or green glass. You know why, yes?" he said, smiling his idiot's grin at the priest.
"I think we've seen enough," Martin said, searching for the stairs in the suffocating darkness.
"You feed them broken glass so they bleed internally, so the liquor saturates the fatty tissues,"
Antonio answered from behind Martin.
"Yes, but why do we use colored glass? It's more expensive. Take a guess," the man said, grabbing Martin.
"I assure you, I have no idea."
"So the cook can find them. It wouldn't do any good to serve you a plate of chevaux l'orange with bits of glass in it, would it?"
Outside, Martin drew in great shaking breaths of the cold air. Even the putrid river air felt refreshing after being in the basement. He watched as Antonio shared some final words with the butcher and handed him a few coins. From where he stood, Martin could see the meat merchant was confused and trying to convince Antonio to at least take some sirloin for his money. Antonio finished his transaction and rejoined Martin.
"Seeing is indeed different from reading about it," Antonio said, offering a cigarette to the shaken Martin.
"Yes, it was worse than even Miss Halsworth's article about it. Just to see it, no wonder she is a vegetarian."
"Yet our comrade, Dr. Tarr, probably has no compunction about sitting down at Marlowe's and ordering the special,"
Antonio said, spitting out a stray piece of tobacco. "That's not entirely fair. Dr. Tarr has always maintained that animals, even those we eat, should be treated humanely."
"What is humane, father? A cow living in the pastures of Illinois, beaten, forced onto a train, and then loaded into the bottom of a steamship to be run up the chute to have its throat cut. How is that humane?"
"It's different, and you know it. That is why you came here, as opposed to any of the other meat houses. It is why Halsworth wrote that article. It is unconscionable what they do to those piglets. But that is the perversity of the rich. I doubt any of the society could even afford such a cruel indulgence. It would be foolish to do something here. What kind of impact would that have? The rich are so decadent, they will find some other perversity. I'm no longer shocked by the callous cruelty of the patrons of this city." Martin watched as his words sank in. Antonio looked back at the meat house and threw away his cigarette. Martin knew that Antonio had told him about the bomb because he wanted to be stopped. He wanted a reason why his destructive, suicidal act would have been simply folly. Martin settled himself in for a long night. He knew that at each Dante-esque stop he would need to find the words, the arguments, to stop Antonio. He would get this friend of the animals through his dark night of the soul, and perhaps even save it before it was too late. Martin could tell Antonio was lost. The 5 points was not an area that strangers could easily navigate, and that was the point.
"We needed to ask someone,"
Antonio said, checking the article. "We should not be here. It is dangerous. Just last week, 2 Metro policemen were..." Martin began to say.
"There,"
Antonio interrupted the priest's tabloid tale.
"I'll ask those punks."
Antonio handed the priest his wallet and timepiece and darted across the street to 2 punks playing mumbly pegs with a rusty fish knife. Martin noticed that Antonio kept a safe distance from the girls. The youngest, in a pair of oversized fireman's boots, sloshed over to Antonio. He handed her an article, and she gave him a few simple directions, while her older sister kicked a rustling cloth sack.
"It's just over there,"
Antonio yelled back to Martin, handing the girl the rest of his pack of cigarettes. O'Malley's was the type of bar sailors went to for a fight, followed by regulars who cleaned up the unfortunate loser's pockets. It didn't have a sign, and even though old man O'Malley had been beaten to death by his wife years earlier, it was still named after him. Since O'Malley's time, little had changed except for the addition of a 4x8-foot zinc-lined pit in the basement. Some rummies even joked the pub was so much the same that the warped bar hadn't seen a wash rag since the old man ran afoul of his wife. The upstairs was filled with half-drunken men. It was too dangerous of a place to get completely sloshed. Martin had seen these men before. They came to his church looking for handouts. They were the type that had never known an honest day's work, or any other honesty, in their lives. A gaggle of pierced adolescents pushed past him to the end of the bar, where an ogre-like bartender was carefully counting out stacks of pennies. One of them, with a padlock and chain around his neck, began furiously arguing with the bartender, shaking a handful of filthy potato bags.
"According to Matilda's article, the pit's downstairs," Antonio said, carefully folding the tattered piece of paper.
"This is a prime place to get pickpocketed. Be careful and don't drink anything," Martin whispered to Antonio.
Martin was a priest, but he had also worked and lived on the Lower East Side his entire life. The Five Points was worse, but he was familiar with both the place and the people. He could see that Antonio was determined, but a little afraid. Martin realized he knew little about his fellow society member, except that he worked on Longacre and that he was out of his depth. Martin was just about to drag him out of the bar when he changed his mind. Let him see rat-baiting. Let him revel in the cruelty of man towards the beasts. He needed to see it, and Martin would play the part of companion if only to keep him from becoming completely unraveled. He had seen others burn with righteous anger in the cause of animals, and seen them consumed by the frightful indifference of their fellow man. He had seen the cold cynicism in Matilda's eyes, and he would not let that happen to Antonio if he could help it. Antonio said something to Martin, but his words were swallowed by the shouts of the bookies and the yelps of the dogs. Martin managed to finagle a spot for them near the edge of the reflecting zinc-lined pit. The regulars preferred the higher-up benches to get a bird's-eye view and to be close to the beer kegs. A pockmarked man jumped into the pit and lifted a tawny pit bull up for the crowd to see. The betting frenzied into a crescendo as the bookies wormed their way through the sweaty throngs, making coated marks on slates that hung around their necks. The handler set the dog into the pit and untied the kerchief that held the muscular dog's jaws shut. The animal's white teeth snapped viciously in the smoky air. The owner announced the dog was named Willie's Trick and had previously dispatched 50 rats in 38 minutes. A rugged man with a shaved head struggled with a squirming undertaker's bag, almost twice his size. He worked to untie the bag and brusquely pulled his hand out with a large rat latched onto his thumb. He shook the rat off to the ground and stomped it to the delight of the crowd. The bag exploded into the pit with a swarm of ferocious river rats slipping on the metal. The owner could barely hold his dog back at the far end of the pit. Sensing the killer dog, the crazed rodents desperately scrambled to escape the pit and piled into the corner. An elaborate clock was lowered. A bell rang, and the pocked-faced man released his pride, fleeing the pit. The dog slipped once before careening into the frantic mound of terrified vermin. The pit bull's mouth ran red with blood as it shook three kitten-sized rats in its spine-pulverizing jaws. The rats regrouped, understanding that escape was impossible, and threw themselves on their attacker. For a moment, only the back legs of the dog were visible under the gnawing blanket of rats. The pit bull's yelps were muffled by the mounds of rodent flesh held in its vice-like jaws. The rat's yellow teeth tore at the front paws and ears of the pain-frenzied animal as it tried to find more room to attack. Moments later, the pit bull escaped the corner, but the rats had already chewed off one ear, and blood streamed down its front legs. The mob was on their feet, nearly crushing the shouting owner as he hung over the wood railing, encouraging his Willy on. A bell rang, and the judges and derbies moved into the pit. The men solemnly checked to determine that the rats were indeed dead, while the owner tried to revive poor Willy. Martin could see by the way the animal struggled for breath, its muscular frame shaking with each inhalation, that the dog would not live the night. Martin led Antonio out of the basement as the slate men shoved money into their pockets while winners and losers queued up for more warm beer and waited the start of the next fight. Martin watched the pit's nightmare etched across Antonio's face. He waited a moment before speaking. "Antonio, even Matilda could not describe it accurately. As you can see,
cruelty begets more cruelty. Perhaps it is a mistake to think that people like this, who experience cruelty and death every day in these alleys and streets, could muster anything resembling compassion. They are ever as much victims as those animals in the pit. It is difficult to see, but it is true. Matilda made a mistake in her article when she ignored that simple truth. What we saw is the result of poverty, of dehumanization. Cruelty is learned, and these streets are the universities of pain.
But the bastards enjoyed it! How could that owner let his dog...
Antonio tried to find the words for the sickness he felt. They're not the problem. Cruelty is these men's inheritance. Killing them, wiping out every pit, would accomplish nothing. Absolutely nothing, my friend. Someday, when cruelty ends, the cruelty of man to man, the pits will be empty. That is the way. That is our hope, Martin said, putting his arm around Antonio.
Martin felt relieved, turning off Broadway onto Longacre Square. The theatergoers were exiting their hacks, rushing home after the shows. The square was filled with people from all over the city, from top hats to scarf-wearing babushkas. The one unifying thread of the metropolis was the need for entertainment, and Longacre Square was its home. Antonio had remained silent nearly the entire long walk north to the theater-lined square. Martin had allowed Antonio the silence, letting him ruminate on his words and what he had seen. Martin was tired from the walk, but he still felt the subtle energy he always experienced when retrieving a lost soul.
"I really should get back. I have a sermon I must prepare," Martin said, clasping Antonio's shoulder in a fraternal way.
"I wanted to show you what I work. It won't take long. Will you come?"
Martin nodded. The two men crossed the wide avenue towards a mountain of pseudo-Baroque architecture. A forest of plastered Greek statues and reliefs covered the nearly block-long edifice. Edison's crackling electric lights still lit up the Hippodrome Theater's 30-foot banner. Martin felt small inside the empty auditorium, a feeling he had when he was a seminary student visiting the great cathedrals in Europe. The stage rose in the back like a tall ship, full of glistening hard wood and innumerable coats of wax and oil that shone in the gloom.
18 years I worked for the Scheinbergs here at the Hippodrome. I worked here before it was even called the Hippodrome. I've seen thousands of people pay their 2 bits and enter this hall, Antonio said,
mainly to himself, as he walked like a somnambulist toward the stage steps.
How many people does this place hold? Martin asked, his voice hushed with appreciation.
5,500 of men, women, and children. 8 shows a week. Come up here, Antonio said, his voice echoing from the stage.
The Italian pulled a lucifer from his pocket and lit one of the gas footlights, casting a thin stream of illumination across the vast stage. The light ended on the side of a huge glass aquarium.
That board is 40 feet up, even though the posters say 50, he explained,
pointing out the tall, extra-wide diving platform stretching high above the still water.
I know, because I ran the cables almost 100 feet to the back. What you and the audience can't see is that the wood is connected to a steam generator in the basement. You may ask why, but first let's go up. You can only understand from up there. Don't worry, there's an elevator.
Antonio didn't wait for a reply, but disappeared into the darkness backstage. Martin had no choice but to follow. Antonio called to Martin from the edge of the board. Martin grasped the iron of the catwalk until the coolness of the metal disappeared. The priest was not afraid of heights, but there was something disorienting about the long ramp leading up to the board. It was terrifying.
Of course, with the lights, the Duke wouldn't be able to see anything from where you're standing. This is for obvious reasons. But come here, Antonio said, beckoning him.
Martin screwed up his courage and made his way up the ramp, careful not to trip on the smooth wooden ribs.
Are you sure it will hold both of us?
Martin questioned, trying to keep his voice steady.
Dukes, all of them, weigh a lot more than the two of us. Trust me,
Antonio said, sitting down, letting his boots hang stories above the darkened stage. Martin made it to the board and immediately stopped. His chest tightened like a screw, and he fought back his vertigo.
You said Dukes? There is more than one?
He asked, staring at his feet and not the sides.
Of course. Dozens over the years. When a full-grown horse hits the water from this height, many terrible things can go wrong.
In fact, we always had a spare duke, just in case the shock of a bad flop killed the horse right away. That's why there's the trapdoor you passed. Now look over the side from where I sit, Antonio said.
Martin tried to will his legs forward, but couldn't. Something about being so far above the stage made the huge tank seem ridiculously small.
I won't. I can't, he said, with more anger than he felt. No, of course not. It takes a lot of getting used to, so you can imagine how hard it was to get a horse to the edge. You know this is safe. You see me on the edge, and you know every day, and twice a day on Saturdays, a full-sized horse trots off this platform, but your body refuses. It's normal. Look down at your feet.
Martin hadn't even noticed the bare copper wire grid on the platform until now. He could see the black outlines of the wire where it had singed the wood.
They put copper-lined shoes on the horse, and when they come up the ramp, it was my job to throw the switch. You see, a horse won't run to the side or backward when in pain, but will always go forward. That is how we make stars here at the Hippodrome.
You should write an article. If people knew, Martin started, taking a step back from the edge.
An article to teach other people? Do you really think even the children believe a horse would jump into a tank of water on its own from here?
You have to believe that if people... Antonio jumped up and moved towards Martin.
Belief is your occupation. I already told you what I did. I know the audiences I have seen...
Antonio's violent coughs cut off his sentence. He hacked so terribly that Martin believed he could feel the board shake. Let's get down, Martin said, retreating back to the catwalk.
Antonio directed the priest with hand gestures, his powers of speech stolen from him by his coughing, to the other ladder leading to the backstage. Martin was so relieved to be down from the diving platform, he hadn't even noticed Antonio fiddling with a lock by a trunk marked Fireworks, No Smoking. Antonio removed a large leather bag from the trunk and set it down carefully by his feet.
That's it? Martin whispered.
Antonio nodded and said,
It took me 6 months to make it. It's delicate, but it will do the job. I got the recipe from an anarchist pamphlet last May Day.
Antonio, I see what this is all about. Just because of what you saw, I don't mean tonight, I mean the past 18 years. You feel guilty, and now at the end of your life you want to do something to make up for it somehow.
Maybe I do. Shouldn't we take responsibility? Doesn't someone have to take responsibility?
No. That is, yes, but not this way. Who is responsible? You? You were doing a job. It was a job, and maybe jobs like that you had should not exist. But they do. If you didn't do it, someone else would.
But that can't be an excuse.
No, of course not. You want to find someone to blame. Maybe you even blame yourself, but everyone is to blame. Look at my shoes. I have dedicated myself to helping animals like St. Francis, and yet my shoes are no better than the pit we saw, or the board we were on. The leather, the glue made from horses, and even the laces. Do you know where they came from? I'll tell you. Cats. Kittens, actually. Their stomach linings are used to make these laces. Tonight I'll take a cab home, because I need to work on a sermon on how we must all respect God's creation, animals included. Yet I know, just as you do, how hack horses are treated in this city. I have wept to see old, wise horses whipped bloody when they no longer can see which way to turn. I have even been to the so-called stables on 17th Street. These prisons are enough to make you sick. Yet tonight I'll ride back to the rectory. You want to blame the 5,000 average people who come to this theater and hundreds other places like it to escape their lives? How dare you judge them? How dare you judge yourself? That is for God only. So who is to blame?
Martin stared at Antonio, who looked down at his bomb. Martin waited for his answer, but there was none. Sure, he had made his point, and now having a theme for his sermon, he was eager to return to the rectory. He was convinced he had saved Antonio from seeking his misguided and sinister vengeance.
Martin did not feel the fatigue of having missed an evening's rest. He had worked through the night on a sermon, convinced it was the best he had ever written. He would open with Revelations 5:13. Martin was pleased that the church pews were filled elbow to elbow. He began the benediction and looked out over his kneeling flock,
In the back row, Antonio remained standing. Martin locked eyes with the Italian as he lifted the leather case above his head. Neil was slurping noodles from a paper box on the corner of Mulberry as Matilda in her morning dress glided between the screaming fire wagons across the street.
The good doc didn't make it to the pet store, Neil said, between mouthfuls of chopay.
Most of us never do, and that's probably for the best.
Do you want me to go fish him out?
I'll do it, Matilda said, heading for the opium den.
Neil threw the empty box in the gutter and followed the fire wagons rushing toward St. Francis.
This has been the New Mercury Players production of Antonio's Answer, a short story from the Catastrophone Orchestra collection, read by Ben Church. The Catastrophone Orchestra and other dangerous fiction publications can be found at the Radical Publishing Collective out of New York City, Combustion Books. Visit combustionbooks.org for a list of other subversive offerings. This New Mercury Players production was recorded at the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios, and I was your host, Mike Cannon.